Welcome to the My Money, My Lifestyle podcast. We discuss all things money because whether or not we like it, money matters. I'm your host, Maya Fisher-French, and welcome to our first episode of 2025. I really hope this is going to be a good year for all of us. We have a few tailwinds, fortunately. We have interest rates starting to decline. Inflation is slowing a bit, which does make it easier for us to get our finances back on track. I thought that given we're starting a new year, it would be good to go back to basics and discuss some of the important money principles we should follow. My guest today is Fulu Mashapa. She recently published her book, Mind Your Sense, A Practical Approach to Financial Freedom. So Fulu asked me to read her draft copy and to write the foreword, which I was very privileged to do so. And what I really loved about the book is the way that Fulu uses her own experience with money, both as a child and entering the world of money as an adult. Her book is relatable and real, and I believe it will provide any young professional with the tools and motivations to get their own finances right on track. So welcome, Fulu. I'm very excited to finally, we've been talking about this podcast for a while, so really glad to be chatting to you now.
Oh, thank you so much, Maya, for having me. I think it's a good way to start the year, and I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. You know, for this podcast discussion, as I mentioned to you, I want to share your experiences as a young professional. I mean, you're an actuary, you entered the world of money, you had to open your bank accounts, buy a car, budget, all of those things. But before we go there, I really Yes. loved the way in your book, in your intro, you write that money has a personality. But in the hands of different users, it takes on different personalities. And you conclude that we give money the personality it has in our hands. Maybe let's just talk a little bit about that.
100%. So I think it came from an observation I made growing up, seeing how different adults sort of handle money. And I realized that it wasn't really much about how much you're making, because I grew up seeing my mother, who started off as a staff nurse, but was able to build a home and sustain us as her kids. And then you have an uncle who was earning a bit more than my mother, but still you couldn't see what he was doing with his money. And even as, you know, a university student, there were some students who were getting an allowance that was way better than mine. But before the month end, they'll be asking me to like give them a loan so that they can survive to the end of the month. So I started realizing it's not much about the money. It's really about who's handling the money and how good they are in terms of how they handle it, how they plan for it, how they do their stuff. So that's sort of where that phrase came from.
Well, I love it. And I think it's really important, because so many people feel disempowered. They say, oh, if I had more money then. But yes. I always say to people, if you can't handle the money you have now, how are you going to handle more money? And I think that is, yeah. you know, understanding that, and understanding that the way you handle your money today is whatever. If you have 1 cent or 1 rand or 100 rand or 1 million rand, you know, you need to know how to manage it.
You really do know how to manage it. And I think that's also one misconception that we have around savings as well. We say, oh, I'll only start saving or investing when I have more money. But if you're struggling to start to save now when you have little, chances are you're not going to be able to do it when you have more money.
I imagine when most people get a salary increase or promotion, they don't think, yay, now I can save more. They think, yay, what am I going to spend it on?
Exactly. Now I have more money to spend. And we see that lifestyle inflation creeping in. And suddenly, you now want a better car. You want to stay in a better location. There's so many things that you want to spend on, but not necessarily, you know, I want to start saving finally.
Well, let's chat a little bit. I wanted to talk about your experiences, because that's what came across in the book for me. And that's what you've written it from. You've written it from your experience, and you've obviously put some really, really good advice and information in the book, which is, makes it extremely relatable. But let's talk about you. You graduate, you get your first salary, or, you know, how does it all feel to you, you know, navigating this space? Because let me just tell you something. When you are a graduate, especially a graduate as you are from, you know, with a pretty good degree, you must have inundated by bank offers for credit cards and overdrafts and car finance and all those things.
Yeah. So I remember in my final year, actually, of university, I started thinking around, oh, next year I'll be working. And at that point, even after like 4 years of studying actuarial science, it's pretty much in the finance space, I still felt a bit unequipped to handle my own finances. And that's when I started just reading books and listening to podcasts around, okay, how can I actually manage my money better? Because I realized that I didn't have the right knowledge, the skills to do it. My credit score was non-existent at the time. And I thought to myself, we need to prep before we get out there and get that first salary. So final year, I spent it pretty much preparing for that first salary. And I would say I had this really ambitious budget in my mind. I was going to get my salary, and because we get paid relatively well, and I was a student, so I thought 50% of my money can go towards my savings. I don't need to use, the 50%. I can just chunk it away. And I think I've always been a big saver and not necessarily a big spender. So that's why the whole thing of I can actually save 50% of my salary, and do that. But then Jan, bills and reality kicked in. Realized that I had to move from Cape Town to Joburg. So that was one thing. I had to start a job. We were going to the office. I had to buy outfits and prepare for work. And this is before I even get paid. So I'm thinking, okay, I had a bit of savings from varsity. I'm going to use that and some help from my parents as well to sort of get through the first month. And when the money came in, that plan that I had of saving 50% went out of the window because I didn't have a bed. I remember, I was just like, if I can buy one thing, it's just a bed. Get a bed. I was staying with a relative for that first month. And then I realized, okay, I'll probably need my own space at some point. So I just focused on getting a bed. I remember because we write board exams as we study, I had to also buy like a small desk and a chair for me to sit and study. And then I contributed to the groceries. And also, I remember I had to go to work. So, transport as well. I was using the Gautrain bus to go to work, didn't have a car then. And then I also had to buy more clothes because when you're in varsity, you invest a lot in hoodies and like you just buy tracksuits and then you realize when you
Sneakers,
start working, yeah, I need to have proper outfits. I can't rock up to the office with a tracksuit and be like, hey guys, I'm an actuary, can I just do my work? They'll be like, you're not dressed appropriately. So I ended up, I don't think I saved much really from my first salary. There was just a lot that I had to spend on to just establish myself. But after that, because all those big expenses were out of the way, then I started budgeting properly and managing my money better.
But I think it's such a great, what you explained is just wonderful for people to listen to, especially young graduates, because I actually had a woman approach me, young, also a young graduate, and said, same story. She would now had to move for work. So she was living in, but she hadn't started the job yet. She hadn't had her salary yet, but she had to pay a deposit on her apartment. She had to pay the first month's rent. She had all of these expenses. And she said, is it okay to borrow money to meet those expenses? And I mean, maybe you were fortunate that you had parents who would help you, not everyone does. And I think we need to be realistic in saying, well, in some cases you do have to borrow money, but how do you borrow that money? And do you do it in a way that is manageable? Make sure that you have a proper repayment plan, that you know when that will be paid off. I think these are some of the things that young graduates have to grapple with.
No, that's true. And I remember I was fortunate enough to stay with a relative, but for friends of mine that actually didn't have any relatives in Joburg, had to rent some of the appliances in the apartments before they can actually afford to buy, which was a bit cheaper than going straight ahead and buying everything all at once, So that option is actually there as well. But in cases where you still need money to go rent those things, then we have to be realistic in that people will have to borrow money to actually fund those things. But I think, what becomes important is even as a student, then you start realizing that you need money for that first month of work. It's like that awkward phase where you are no longer a student, you're now working, but you just don't have the money to show for it. You definitely need money for that first month of work.
And even once all those expenses were done, I'm sure that the cost of living surprised you. I think we
Of
again, people
course.
think, oh, it'll cost me this for groceries and the like. And then the reality hits. So, how did you kind of make, like in the end, within maybe 3 or 4 months later, how much of your budget was actually what you thought it was going to be? Or was it just still a lot more?
So I started first month. I was just like, okay, I was thrown off. Didn't realize that there would be all these things that I needed to pay for. And then the following month was also realizing that there's actually more stuff to pay for as an adult. Like university, we never paid for Wi-Fi, never paid for electricity, never paid for water from our pockets, you know, all those things. And now you're an adult, you realize my relative is like, okay, this is the bill. How are we splitting the bill? You know, this is groceries. I remember we ran out of groceries in like a space of 2 weeks. We had to buy more groceries. And I was there like, oh no, 1,000 rands for groceries will be fine. And then it's like, no, it's not enough. You need to pop out more. And you realize that now you had planned to survive on 50%. You're now moving towards 80% of what you had initially planned for because there are all these other things that are coming. So it really hits you, and you just have to adapt as it comes and control what you can. The other stuff, you'll figure them out as you go.
But I think it's probably really great. And I know you definitely do it in your book, you know, explaining a budget or how to put together a budget. But I think that's a really good starting point for a young graduate is to go and get like print out a budget from a household budget and think, oh, look at all these many, many things that I'm going to have to pay for. And just sort of try and understand what that is. And I think in that case, also, when you get all these offers from the banks and car finance and all of that, that you need to realize that, oh, there's all these other expenses I'm definitely going to have to meet first before I go. So in, I mean,
No, true.
in your book, you also spoke about selecting a bank account. And how do you think, you know, as a young graduate, how did you go about saying what is the best bank account for my needs? Again, you're going to be constantly pressurized to upscale. How did you
Of
go about
course.
doing that?
I remember when I started, I was like, I don't need a credit facility. And for the longest time, I had always been, you know, scared of credit to say, I don't want to be one of those adults. We grew up hearing stories of teachers and nurses who would, you know, open a store account or have a credit card and overuse it, and they end up in this big, massive debt that they can't get out of, and they spend years trying to recover from that. So, going into the world of work, I knew for sure that I didn't want to overwhelm myself with credit. So when I started out, I was using a student account. So I just upgraded that to like a normal check account. And I remember I didn't have a credit facility for like that first entire year. And I didn't borrow anything. I was looking at my journals from my first year of work, and I realized one of my highlights for that year was I didn't get any credit. I was excited about that. Like, I managed to at least escape the credit trap and still managed to live below my means using my own salary and still save. So that was my approach. I was like, okay, I don't need much at this point. And it allowed me to also save on the side. So I was like, okay, I know I need to save. I know I need to do normal transactions. At this point, I don't need to overwhelm myself with debt. So didn't consider any credit cards. Offers were coming in. Like once you start working, it's like they know. They're like, oh, don't you want this? Don't you want that? And personal loans were coming in, but I was just like, I'm going to stick to my decision of not taking out any credit and to just focus on building my savings, emergency funds for that first year of work. And the issue of, you know, getting a car and all of that was not in the radar as well in that first year of work, because always I've seen like peers who first 2 months of work, they already have a car. And I'm like, when did you save for your emergency fund? How did you fund all these other expenses that are related with just starting out with work? So first year, I was just like a simple account that'll allow me to do my transactions and allow me to save. That's all I need. I don't need a credit facility. That's how I went about it. Yes.
I think it's such a powerful point you came back to that, you know, for anybody in your position with a good salary that you were on, within 2, 3 months, the first thing is the car. That's the first thing
Yes.
people buy. Without understanding what the cost of living is, without building the basics, the emergency fund, all of those things. So I think that is such a good life lesson. Don't rush. Wait at least a year. Understand your finances before you commit to that car. But you did buy a car.
Yes,
And that
I
also in the book you relate that and how you made those decisions. So maybe just give us a little bit of some insight into how you went around deciding on the right car, income, you know, how much you're prepared to pay, the contract,
Yes.
etc. Yeah.
So I remember first year of work was done, second year of work, I was playing around with the idea of getting a car because we're still, you know, I remember we're still going to the office and all of that. And I thought, okay, I'm staying far. and I didn't want to move because I still wanted to save money. So I thought, okay, staying with a relative, still a good option, but at some point we will need to have this conversation around, do we move, do we stay, do we buy a car, do we not buy a car? And at the time, my goal was to really buy an apartment first. So I delayed the decision to make to buy a car because I thought, let me continue saving and put down a good deposit for the apartment and also all the other fees associated with that. And I was looking around. So I did bump into a property. That's another story we will discuss. And it so happened that because things were delaying on that side, I ended up deciding, let me just take advantage of now interest rates being low, me buying a car, paying it off as quickly as I can, and we will continue to save on the side. So when I started, I was like, there's no way that I'm going to buy a car that costs more than, 7,000 rands a month. Because in as much as I do get paid well, I still haven't built enough in terms of savings. And also, you don't want a car that's going to be high maintenance, such that it's like taking away 50% of your salary just on you owning and maintaining the car. So I decided 7,000 rands was my limit. We're looking at, excluding petrol from that. Petrol was a separate budget, but insurance and installment, that's really what I was going for. And that, of course, took out all the German cars out of my options. I was just like, okay, it's fine. And I had to decide, do I go for a brand new car or a secondhand car? That was also another, decision I had to make. But I felt like I ended up going for a brand new car out of my own irrational reasoning and thinking, because I thought, I love buying things new. Let me just go get this car. And my also another thing is, I actually want to keep this car. I don't want to just buy it, trade it, and get another car. I want to keep it for a while. So at least if I get it brand new, then I can keep it for a bit longer. And even now, I'm still using the same car because I thought if I can pay it off and then have the money, get the installment back, I can use that money for investments and continue. So ended up now deciding, okay, do you go for auto or do you go for manual? Not really a good driver, so auto was a great option. And then the whole process came, okay, which brand do we now go to? And in my final year at UCT, we actually did a whole strategic thinking project around cars, car theft. So there were certain brands that I wasn't going to actually look at, given I'll be staying in Gauteng and, crime in Gauteng and all of that. So safety was also important over and above affordability. And I then ended up telling my parents that I was ready. And I think I had a good deposit. I was aiming for like 10% as a deposit. Ended up going for 15%, and I was able to then negotiate with the bank to at least get a lower interest rate. They ended up giving me like prime minus 1%, which was great at the time. And ended up doing that, went to the dealership. My dad gave me like a whole list of questions because, I mean, I don't know about cars. This is my first time going to actually buy a car. So my dad gave me a whole list of questions to ask. I put that there in the book. And he was saying, you must ask them about the warranties, ask them about the service plan, the full consumption per 100 kilometers. Had no idea the engine strength, And because I come from Limpopo and it's a rural area, we don't have good roads. It was also important for me to get a car that's not like very close to the ground, given that I will have to drive back home. And when I do drive back home, I don't want to leave my car by the side of the road. I needed to get home. So also that was an important consideration in terms of which car I actually end up going for. Petrol consumption as well. All those things, because you don't want to be spending so much on petrol. And then once, I went around and shopped around, tested different cars. And I remember someone gave me this important advice to say, sometimes just get out of your apartment and look at cars that are passing and check the models, check the prices. If you find something that you like, check the price and see how that will turn out. And I decided, I'll be in as much as I want a brand new car, I'll also be, happy with a demo. And ended up going for a brand new that didn't have a demo for the car that I ended up going for. And it was within my budget and I was very much happy. So that's sort of
What
the
was the car in the
process.
end? What car did you get?
Oh, I ended up getting a Suzuki Vitara Brezza.
There you go.
Yes.
Meant all
Yeah.
those requirements. Definitely can go off-road. And I think the
Yes.
important thing is exactly it was within your budget. And
Yes.
you were mentioning that you didn't you were like, do I go new? Do I go secondhand? And one of the reasons to go secondhand is that if you want the German carb for 7,000 a month, then you go secondhand, right? So it is all about your budget. That's actually where it starts. Like,
Yeah.
what can I afford? And
Yes.
then if there is a particular model I want that's outside of that, what are the options for secondhand? So I suppose these are all part of the decision making process. But I want to talk about
100%.
that property because it was great. I mean, I love the way you described how you bought the car and the things you had to think about and off-road and all of this. But you property didn't the first property story was challenging to say the least.
It was. I think because I thought of it as an investment, and also thought about, oh, I want a brand new property. We'll stay there for a while. When I get my bonuses, I'll throw them in, and then I'll get another, and I'll move, and then, lease that property out to someone else, make money out of that. So I think there were a lot of emotions attached to that decision. And I mean, I always do my research, that's for sure. But I sort of felt like, in as much as I did my research, none of the things I read about or things I spoke to people about could have prepared me for what came afterwards. So I decided, let me go, start looking for a property. I'm really excited. My search was very narrow because I said I'm going for new development. And I was like, I know people say there's no space. I mean, I'm still young. I don't need that much space anyway. I can fit my belongings in a couple of boxes, so that'll be fine. So I ended up finding a property on Property 24. Decided to go visit the site, and everything looked, legit, was above board. I spoke to my sister, and she was like, I think this is a great plan. So at that point, they hadn't started building. There was nothing, construction hadn't started, and I had to pay a reservation fee of like 20,000 rands, and they were like, it will knock off the price at the end, so no need to worry about that. And when they immediately gave me the offer to purchase as well, and they were like, this is the offer to purchase, go read as you decide if you feel like you want to go on. If you have any questions, definitely contact us, we will take it from there. So I went home. I think I spent like around a week with the offer to purchase, just reading it out. Nothing really looked out of the ordinary, nothing jumped out for me. And when I got into the contract, I never thought about, what if I change my mind, or what if I want to get out of the contract? So read the contract, felt like, okay, there's nothing, there's nothing here that I should be worried about. And decided on the price, put down the price, and I was like, I'm going to put in the offer. Put in the offer. They were like, we got your offer. The developer accepted, and they were like, you need to pay the reservation fee. Paid the reservation fee, nothing out of the ordinary at that point in time. Everything looked amazing. And they said, we are starting with construction end of the year, so December. Was excited, and I was thinking I can just continue to save, live as I am living right now, save as much money as I can. Also, this gives me a chance to also, pay off the car as well. In the meantime, when the property comes, I'll be sorted. End of the year, go to the site. I'm excited to see what's happening. Nothing is happening. Okay, so I try contact them like, hey guys, what's happening? Why hasn't anyone said anything? At this point, you guys said you would be starting, but there's nothing on site, nothing there. And they were like, no, there's been delays and issues with budget. We're going to start before June next year. Okay, cool. We wait patiently. And then there were also other people who are now complaining, like via email and stuff, to say, what's really happening? No one is saying anything. Can someone explain what's happening? And what was crazy was that this is a reputable property development company. So I wasn't expecting to, face issues with them. It was looking as if we're going to be waiting for 5 years. What do I do? And that basically started a whole legal battle of me trying to get out of that same OTP that I was in. Well, for people who've signed OTP, they know how difficult
So
it is
that's
to get
offered to
out of it.
purchase, just to for the jargon. Yeah.
Yes.
OTP is offered to purchase.
Yeah.
It's not the pin. It's not your one-time pin. So what actually happened?
I
Did
would
you
love.
how much did it actually cost you in the end to exit?
I think close to 20,000 rands. I think it was a long, painful 6 to 8 months of trying to get out of the offer to purchase. And I remember just feeling like, I had this amazing dream of starting with, buying my first property, and this is going to be like an inheritance for my kids and all of that. But that experience really made it sour. And when all of that was done, I even decided I am not going to buy a new development. I am going to look for something that's already there that I can see, feel, touch, and take it from there. Yeah, but I think the most important lesson was just when you get into these contracts, the serious contracts, rather have a lawyer look over the
You
contract.
know, and what it may have cost you for a lawyer would have saved you a lot of money going forward. I mean, I must tell you, my mother's actually in a
Yes.
very, very similar situation, bought into an orphan plan retirement village. She was
Oh.
supposed to move in June 2022. It's still not finished. So I know the, you know, two, three, we're going to be looking at 3 years. So it is off plan. If you're buying off plan, just know it comes with massive risks. But I, you know, one of the other things, it's so interesting
Yes.
to me that you spoke about seeing property as a way to have passive income. And you know,
Yes.
when I a lot of the people who come to me with financial difficulty, a lot of them have got investment properties that are not working out. So a lot
Yeah.
of people go into an investment property and they just think, oh, well, I'll rent it out, you know, pay off the bond and I'll have an income. And they don't realize the additional expenses. And especially if you're buying into something like a sectional title, there's levies and
Yes.
there's, you know, by the time you paid rates, taxes, levies, maintenance, all these additional costs,
Yeah.
interest rates go up, you suddenly are having to really meet a big shortfall, and that can put a lot of people into financial difficulty. So I'm always concerned that people think property is an easy investment, and you know, property
Cheers.
is probably one of the more difficult investments. And I think
Yeah.
we just people are always scared to invest in the market because it's dangerous. And I actually think property is far
Yes.
more dangerous than the
It is.
markets. You know, so that I mean,
Yeah, it
that's an
is.
interesting
And
one.
I remember like a year after buying my now property, I remember thinking I shouldn't have rushed to actually get a property. And I think we have this pressure as well to be like, no, why are you renting? You need to own. And we sort of think of why are you paying? Think of it as why are you paying someone else's bond? But you realize I have like 3, 5K extra that I'm paying on those property, which if I was renting, I wouldn't be paying this. Coming from levies, there's insurance as well. Now, if you need to maintain the property, those costs will have to come out of your pocket. Whereas if you were renting, then your landlord will have to cover that. So I remember I had that buyer's regret afterwards, where I was just like, those 3, 5K that I'm paying towards my property could have easily been using that to invest in the stock market.
I think it's a very
Yeah.
powerful, and I agree with you. I think there's always for young people, there's always seems to be this rush to own a property. And people often
Yes.
feel, young person often feel that they haven't, they're not where they should be if they don't own a property. And yet,
Yes.
you know, waiting, renting, being strategic, making sure you're financially ready for it is there's a lot to be said for it, actually. And especially, well, if you know, anybody who bought in sort of 2020 is just in absolute pain because the interest rates went up
Yeah.
so significantly. So yeah, I mean, I think your story, and that's why I wanted to talk to you about all of your experiences, because I think that this is so typical of any of us who start working and the
Yes.
belief systems we have around where we should be and what we should be doing with our money. But you mentioned
Yeah.
the stock market. I want you to tell everyone where do you invest? What do you do with your money? You obviously have savings for emergency funds. You invest. How have you gone about putting that together?
So in terms of my investments, I went and realized, okay, do I have the right expertise to be able to invest all of my money? And the answer was no. Pretty much when I do invest in like apps like Easy Equities and stuff, that's like a gamble. It's sort of seeing Sasol went down, and I want to take advantage of, the short-term gains I can get from that. But because I want to invest more long-term towards like building wealth and being very comfortable as well, I thought I need professionals to sort of help me with my investments. So I ever since I started working, not definitely not my first month of work, probably from like my fourth or fifth month of work, I have a regular, the debit order started as like 1,000 rand. So I was just doing the bare minimum, trying it out to say, let's just take 1,000 rands and put it in stocks every month. And this is money that I've never touched since I started. So this is like more long term. And as my salary went up, I started increasing the debit orders to now where I'm like, okay, 5K can go towards that and I can still do all my other stuff that I need to do on the side. So I normally Investec handles all my sort of stock market investments. And then my emergency fund also sits with them because I bank with them. So my emergency fund is in their Prime Saver account. Then I have this normal debit order on a monthly basis that basically goes towards my share portfolio. And then you do have months where I'm trying out different things because I continuously want to learn so that one day I'll be able to say, okay, I'm building up a portfolio for myself. So I do have a smaller portfolio that I manage on the side that doesn't have much money because I'm like, I don't want to risk losing my money. So that's sort of me learning, trial and error, learning new things as I go. And most of the stuff that I invest in, it's like your ETFs. I've picked a couple of companies for shares, and that hasn't been going well, but I'm waiting it out. And yeah, normally it's just, just the Standard Bank Group has been doing well for my portfolio, shout out. And then the top 40 index, I've definitely invested in that. And I think for that, it's something that I feel it's safer. So even if I am doing that myself, I do not mind. But that's sort of where my money is going on a monthly basis.
So I think you're actually very similar to me. I mean, my background, stockbroking. I actually worked for a stockbroking firm, and I worked on the trading desk, and I invested people's money. And yet, I don't. I'm exactly like you. I give my the bulk of my money sits in managed funds because I don't. I'm not going to sit. I don't have the time to watch the stock market and analyze shares individually. I just don't have the time for it. So I also every now and then I have a little speculation. I think, that's looking interesting. Maybe I'll take a little stake there. But again, it's a very, very small part of my portfolio. And I think that is again one of the bit of the myths that I think we see being. Be out there is that people, kind of think that they can make a lot of money investing on their own, and that investing in shares is easy, and they listen to friends, and then what often happens is they lose money because of that, and then they're scared to go back into the markets, and that's the worst thing you can do. If you get really badly burnt, and now you're no longer investing in something, it's probably one of the easiest ways to make money. Let's be honest. We've spoken that property is not so easy. Putting your money in it and just letting it grow in a broad, diversified, investment, that has to be really easy. I always say, when you invest in companies and things like that, the CEOs of those companies are working for you every single day. I think it's a miraculous thing. But we have to be very circumspect about this kind of easy money. And I worry a lot about the proliferation of these forex trading platforms and encouraging people to really get into very, very speculative trades, believing that they're going to make money. So it's interesting for me. You're an actuary, you know numbers, you're a smart woman, you've looked at everything, and you're saying, I leave the bulk of it to the professionals, but I'll take my chances on the side. And I think that's a pretty good strategy going forward.
Yes, it is. It is. And especially when you're looking at more long-term type of investments, you really don't want to be gambling with your money because this is like your hard-earned money that you want to use at some point in the future. So you do want to know that it's in good hands. And when I evaluated it, I was like, my hands, the good hands that I can put this money in. I was like, no, definitely there's someone more well-trained who can actually do this for me. And the time that it takes as well, I think you mentioned it. It's also a lot. We're busy, we're doing different things, staring at where the stock market is going all the time and analyzing things is not possible.
And I just wanted to briefly end off because we speak about things that people love to talk about, which is property and investing and buying cars and buying all these things. But what's really, really important, of course, is ensuring your income, such as your life cover, your income protection. So how did you, I mean, you're obviously employed, so you probably get employee benefits, but how have you looked at that side of it? And being an actuary.
Yes. Oh yeah, our specialty is risk and risk management and insurance as part of that. So when I started working, we're fortunate enough as grads, my very first employer, Old Mutual, gave us financial advices to sort of do that needs analysis for us to sort of identify what are you getting from your group life insurance. What can you add on to the group life insurance to sort of protect yourself? So majority actually of, my insurance sits with my employer, but I've just added on to that because, the benefits are sometimes not adequate. You don't get like your critical illness stuff, income protection as well. So we had to then develop on the side, take out products to sort of supplement my group life. So that's sort of how I went about it. But I mean, when I moved to my new employer now, I was like, okay, I mean, I have income protection. Do I really need critical illness? So every single time when you change jobs or when the benefits change, you need to have the conversation again to say, I'm still young. Is this relevant? Do I need to pay for this now? Do I not pay for this now? But for life cover, they're like, the younger you are, you're going to pay less. And we see that in the calculations as well. So I was like, okay, this is one thing that I can't afford to compromise on. But there are other benefits that I'm like, you guys just want me to be overinsured. I think I can take on the risk and live with it. I understand it. So that's basically how I went about it.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned critical illness, and maybe that's a story you and I should work on together around the risk of becoming ill. Now, obviously, at your age, it's very, very small. By my age, it's starting to, there is actually, they call it the red zone. Between the ages of 50 and 60, you actually have an extremely high chance of getting a critical illness. And, but if you take it out younger and you do something like a level premium, where effectively you're paying a little bit more when you're younger, so that you're not paying a full sort of premium when you're older, you're
When
kind of,
you're older.
you kind of cross-subsidizing your older self with your younger self. There are obviously, opportunities there that, that you want to look at, because if you start going to take out critical illness at the age of 50 for the first time, you're going to pay a very high premium. So these are some of the
High
things, I
premium,
suppose. And
true.
it's very hard when you're in your 20s to be worrying about critical illness when you're 50.
Yes,
So
start thinking about it.
there's so many other things to think about.
Exactly, and you also need to balance. You need to balance between, protection versus, I guess, the same thing that I can live with. I often find you don't also want to now take all your salary, put it into insurance, and not invest and not save. So that balance. But I'm like, okay, I'm approaching 30. I need to start revisiting some of these decisions as I get older. The
And of course,
priorities are changing.
and reaching 30, I know you are on a medical aid. Obviously, medical you would be with your
Yes.
employer, but I mean that's a big one people forget about. I think if you have not been on a medical scheme before the age of 35, the medical scheme can charge you a late joiner penalty. So it's very
They do.
important when you turn 30 to start thinking about getting some of these some of these insurance.
No, 100%. You don't want, I mean, already at my age, I feel like it's ridiculous. The amount that I'm paying on a monthly basis, like close to 3,000 rands. Over that, it's ridiculous. But you realize, I mean, I can't afford to go without this thing. So we would rather pay the price now and then reap the benefits later. But if you don't pay the price now, I can imagine if you are starting out when you're like 35 or something, it's going to be ridiculous. The premium will be ridiculous.
Life would be so much easier if we knew when we were going to get sick, when we were going to die.
Unfortunately, actuaries will be out of jobs.
I just want to say thank you. It's been really interesting chatting to you. And I've really enjoyed having a perspective of a young person starting works, navigating all of these things, but doing it in a way that obviously setting you up for success. And I really encourage or anyone listening to this podcast to please go get your book. Where can they get hold of it?
They can get my book. It's on my website. I think I'll send you the link as well. It's mashedenigroup.co.za.
I'll put the
Yeah.
link
But if they,
into the podcast.
yes, also on my social media platforms, the link is there as well.
Excellent. And I think it is, I really enjoyed the book. I thought it was accessible, readable, loved your personal anecdotes, and the way you related some of the, just why these things are important. So good luck, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me. Truly, truly, truly enjoyed this conversation.